Well, with affordable housing a critical priority for the Park City Council and something that the Summit County Council is certainly considering as it looks at purchasing property near Jeremy Ranch for a transit and affordable housing development, we invited Scott Loomis, Executive Director of the Mountainlands Community Housing Trust, for a look ahead. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Leslie. Happy New Year.
Yeah, you too. Well, let's take a look back first. 2016, actually a pretty good year for affordable housing. We saw the opening, of course, of the Richer Apartments and then the introduction of the Discovery Project there near Timberline to the Snyderville Planning Commission.
Yeah, it was actually a reintroduction on the Discovery. It's been approved, and the only issue is the plat, and I think that's finally going to get approved the first part of January. So it'll be moving forward. And you know, unfortunately, most of these things, they take some time, and they will not be available probably till 2018 at the earliest. So we still have that huge need out there, and it's looking better than it was a year or two ago, but there's still a lot to do.
Right. So how many units are we talking about out there?
Well, this past year, Mountainlands completed 11 homes, and we've got 15 under construction, and then 28 units at Richer Place. Out at Silver Creek Village, which is again approved about 5 or 6 years ago, they've finally started the infrastructure there, and there's a total of 330 units required out there, which is going to take some time, but at least that'll be getting underway. Discovery will have 30. And, of course, the county, Klein-Dolly, they haven't decided exactly what they're going to do with it yet, but it looks like they're going forward with the purchase. And Park City Municipal Corporation is doing a lot, looking at properties they have, plus looking forward. So from my standpoint, after over 15 years of doing this, it's the most optimistic I've been in terms of looking forward the next 2 or 3 years that we're going to get some affordable housing.
Yeah. With regard to the Discovery Project, Snyderville Planning Commissioners have asked if the affordable units are mixed in enough with the market units. Is this an issue for you or not?
Well, it was. And sadly, we had discussions about a year and a half ago with the developers. They were trying to create some attainable housing, which would be more for the police, fire that make more than 80% of the median income. And we had a discussion with some of the county attorney staff, and they agreed we could present it to the Planning Commission, and then we got to the Planning Commission about a year later after a lot of work, and we're told that no integration is required because it was represented in the some of the discussions, although it certainly wasn't identified in any of the documents that were part of the approval. So instead of 46 units that were going to be affordable, attainable, that they were going to donate the land to Mountainlands, we were going to do the infrastructure and then create these units. They're down to 30 units that the developer will develop, and they'll be spread out throughout the development.
All right. So you don't really have a role in that at all?
Well, we'll be involved in approving the and hopefully locating the parties who will be purchasing those units, but that's probably a year down the road at this point.
Yeah, we did a study in Summit County, gosh, maybe what, 3-4 years ago, where we saw a shortage of what, some 800 units?
Well, it depends on who you talk to, but yes, there is a shortage. Jeff Jones, who the county's economic development director, talks about economic development, talks about a 1,000 unit shortage. I believe that. It's a growing problem because he also talks about 1,000 to 1,500 jobs being created each year for the next 5 years. So if we want even a third of our workforce to be housed here, that's still another 150 to 250 units required each year. So we've got a ways to go. But I am encouraged because I think with the county and the city involvement, we Mountainlands are working on a very substantial project potentially and a couple of smaller projects. So it isn't going to be tomorrow, but in the next 2-3 years, there should be some product available for people that work here and need to live here.
Yeah. And I guess, though, I mean, we saw the writing on the wall years ago. And I guess it's like if we had, been as proactive about it back then as we are now, we probably would have at least a third more units built because of just the cost involved.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, Jack Thomas, I think the mayor, I hit it right on the head. We should have started this 20 years ago, and I've been saying for 15 years, and fortunately people at the city get it now, is you can't live in studies or meetings, and you need to do something about it and pull the trigger and go, and it's great to see the support that we're getting now from both city and county council.
All right. So what do we have on the books then for 2017? You say that certainly Discovery will get built, and what else? I mean, is Mountainlands involved in?
Well, we've got, as I say, 15 homes under construction. We just, hopefully today I'm going to get them wrapped up. We're purchasing 9 more lots for our self-help program in Francis. I've got a 35 to 40 unit project that I'm working on in Heber. And then, as I say, a very, I can't really discuss it now, but a potentially very large project, which will cover a lot of the basis of our needs.
Right. And there's also a parcel, I believe, out near the old, off the road near the stock building supply. It may be part of the Mayflower development, but I have heard of that being talked about for an affordable housing or an apartment building. You know anything about that?
I'm not sure which one you're talking about, but there are a couple of sites in the county. And the county is going through a zone right now, a rezoning, not a rezoning, but a creating 2 new zones that could create multi-use developments, which would be residential and commercial, and tie it into transit-oriented development as well. So there's 3 or 4 parcels in the county that potentially could be affected by that zone, which could create not only affordable housing, but solve some of the transportation issues as well.
Yeah, and I recall a point where you were pretty upset with the ski resort and other large companies that just weren't doing much to house their out-of-country employees. What's the latest on that?
Well, it's true. They've not that they don't want to do it. It's just that it's very difficult. They've called every owner of apartment and land and developer and tried to get, and I'm speaking of Vail primarily, because Deer Valley's been doing something and they want to do more, but it's very difficult for them too. And their business is skiing, so they don't have the capital to put into it. And we don't have entitled land. We don't have a lot of opportunities. But I think going forward, as the city's involved and the county's involved, and we have some larger developments, that they're going to be able to participate in affordable housing. And it's not that they don't want to. I don't think at this point there's been a change in the last couple of years. I think they get it that it's critical for them. And as far as this, like the canyons, they're taking steps forward, and the trigger is there now with the development. So they've got to make some decisions and move forward with those as well. So, again, that's going to be a few years down the road, but at least things are moving in the right direction versus being ignored.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to?
Well, I just seasonal housing, again, with all our visa employees arriving in December. It's sort of the same this year as it's been. People show up and there's absolutely nothing available, but somehow they find a bed. So it's been that way for 16 years that we've been doing the roommate roundup. And it's never easy, but somehow they all land.
Yeah. Is that still ongoing at this point, or you're done with it?
It's pretty well over. You still get a few people arriving very late in the season after the roommate roundup's over. They come knocking on the door and say, help us find some housing. And we don't hear back from them after. Used to be, they'd be hanging around for a week or 10 days before they find it. But usually they go away and for a couple of days you hear from them, and then they eventually land. So it's always a struggle, but thanks to the community for opening up their homes and rentals for them.
Okay. Scott, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you, Leslie.
Scott Loomis, the Executive Director of Mountainlands Community Housing Trust. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. It's 8:27 now. Good morning. Well, in an effort to encourage renewable energy, Summit County once again offering to waive the building permit fees in 2017 for those who choose to install solar panels. In the studio to tell us more, Summit County Sustainability Manager Lisa Yoder. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So this is what, the fourth year or so that the counties offer these?
Yes. We started this in 2013 in conjunction with the community solar program that we ran in 2013. And each year we've evaluated and continued it.
All right. So how much would somebody have to pay otherwise?
$385.50.
Okay. So that helps.
Yes. It helps in the cost, helps reduce the cost, and we want to do that to encourage solar.
Yeah. What have you seen in terms of solar installations and over the years? Do you have those numbers?
I don't have them with me, but we've seen incredible growth. It was slow from about 2005 to 2013, but then we see significant growth, especially in the years that we run the program, in 2013 and then this past year, 2016.
All right. So how does the county then make up that lost revenue? I mean, we saw here in Park City, if the fees are waived for affordable housing, that then it has an impact on the staff. I mean, they still have to do the work, but essentially we're not raising the money to pay for that work.
Right. It's a minimal impact. It's less than 1% of the total building fee revenue. I mean, it equates to one. In 2013, it equated to approximately 1.5 new single-family home permits. In 2016, we had, there was 110 homes that put solar on their property, rooftop or ground mount. Not all of those were in Summit counties. So the number of, I don't have the final numbers for the year that were county permits, but it was roughly about $35,000 in revenue, which equates to about 5 or 6 new single-family home permits. So it's pretty marginal impact to the revenue.
Yeah, we're not having to raise fees.
No,
on the rest
certainly
of the...
not. Absolutely not.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about other sustainable projects that Summit County will be working on for 2017.
Well, in 2016, we completed a solar feasibility study. We hired a consultant, and we looked at all the properties that the county owns, all of our buildings, property for ground mount potential. We also included the districts, water district, fire district, and evaluated and prioritized the facilities that would be best suited to solar. And then we can continue looking ahead. Then we prioritized, and we will be budgeting for those installations.
So what are those projects?
In 2017, we'll be putting solar on the transit center and on the new Camas service building library. And then the next projects that are the most appropriate and the most beneficial would be, in order, Public Works and then the Richens building. Now, they're not budgeted, but they will be considered in the budget. And that's what the study did, was give us, you know, the numbers, approximate budget, and the value that we could expect from them.
Yeah. What other efforts is the county making in terms of, besides just solar?
Well, we're looking at the possibility or the feasibility of making renewable energy available to residents countywide. That's an ongoing study in partnership with Park City and Salt Lake City.
Is that with the Rocky Mountain Power solar farms? That's subscriber solar, or
not exactly. It's like, what would it take if all the residents wanted renewable energy? How would we get that to them? It's a massive undertaking, potentially. So it just looks at the possibility and how that would impact residents cost-wise. We don't have the results of that yet. It's still underway.
Okay. And let's see. You and I have both served on the SCPW, the Summit Community Power Works Executive Board, for the last couple of years. Tomorrow is the official 2-year competition for that Georgetown University Energy Prize ends. How do you think we did?
I think we did really well. The community knowledge that has been gained, the actual uptake on the number of switches, the LED switch, comfort switch, the power switch, is good. Our narrative is fantastic, that we're a broad socioeconomic diverse community when you look at the whole countywide community. And if we can make these kind of changes here, we should be able to make these sort of changes everywhere or anywhere else. So that was the goal of the competition. And I think our narrative indicates that we have good models that are replicable and sustainable and innovative that could be dropped in anywhere in the country.
And certainly one of those is something that I know you worked hard on, was the home energy improvements to help save energy for people in their homes. We did, you had, what, 100 audits? How did those go?
We have completed, I think, 90 of them. A few dropped out with the holiday weekend or week this week that were scheduled. We will be doing to be eligible for the home energy score, one had to do a survey. So we're gathering and compiling the data from that survey to understand more about why people chose to do energy audits. We will interview them in about, 3 months to find out, did they actually implement any of the recommendations? So part of the purpose of that, of providing those audits, is to gain information to how to better inform programming going forward.
Right. So we don't have that information yet in terms of whether or not people have followed up.
Correct. We don't. And a lot of the fixes or recommendations will be significant investments. So we didn't anticipate people would immediately, you know, replace furnaces or go out and buy windows necessarily if those were the recommendations. But it was to inform, raise awareness, gather information. And certainly we do want existing homes to be made more efficient.
All right. So any other plans then for 2017?
A lot more of the same. Continue implementing the Climate Action Plan, which is largely energy efficiency and to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. A lot of that centers around the built environment, like we're talking about, weatherizing homes, looking at encouraging above code construction in new construction. And as you know, there's a lot of growth slated for the area, so we would like to encourage better than code construction and incentivize the affordable housing to adopt above code construction. Reduce emissions from transportation with the transportation bond that passed, looking at ways to reduce emissions and improve efficiency in transportation.
Yeah, and when you talk about building codes, that's all you can do is encourage, right? Because it's a state building code. And
yes.
Okay. All right, anything else you want to tell us?
I can't think of anything. You caught me off guard there.
Okay.
It's funny for being here. I'm off guard.
All right. Lisa, thanks.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Lisa Yoder is Summit County Sustainability Manager. You're listening to the Local News Hour. 8:38 now. Good morning. Well, today, Utah Ice Castles opens at the Homestead Resort. In the studio to tell us more, I have the owner and co-founder of Ice Castles, Brent Christensen. Good morning, Brent.
Good morning.
So describe Ice Castles. What is it?
The best way to describe it is... Well, Ice Castles is the name that was kind of given as people would come look at it. They, you know, early on, they say, well, let's go look at the Ice Castles. So that's what we've named it. But it's actually more of an experience like being inside of like ice caves or inside of a glacier. It's a little bit more of a natural feel to it. So that's what we call it. But to unless you've been in one, it's a little bit different of an experience.
So it started in Utah and you've
mm-hmm.
grown?
Yeah, yeah. I started it actually in my yard when we lived down in Alpine after we moved to Utah and was just experimenting. And I stumbled upon this idea of using icicles and spraying water and creating these little structures and kind of took off from there. Yeah, started in Utah. First couple of years were in Utah. And then we've a few years later, I brought on a business partner. And now we're in 4 states and also in Edmonton.
Wow. And so is it kind of based on like building an igloo? Is that the philosophy?
No, it's actually very different than anything that has been done. We will grow and harvest, for lack of a better word, about 5,000 to 10,000 icicles per day. And those are that's our building material. We'll paste those information where we want these structures to grow, and then water is sprayed on them, and they collect in the form of ice. And then we'll climb up on top of that and add another layer the next day, and eventually we'll create arches and tunnels and caves using that method. So
how long does it take to build a castle?
Once we get cold weather, if the weather is cold and solid from the time that we start spraying the water until we open to the public, it's usually about 4 weeks. And about 8,000 man hours within those 4 weeks. So it's pretty intense. And so fortunately, we have at each location, we have an awesome crew of really hardworking folks.
Yeah. So we've got next week. I mean, that's perfect for mm-hmm. something that you do with very, very cold temperatures. Right. But how do you ensure our safety when, you know, if the temperature should go above freezing?
Well, the nice thing about, see, people will look, you walk into some of these caverns and it's icicles hanging all over. And people's natural reaction is they're fearful that an icicle will fall on them. And we do see icicles falling when they're frozen on the edge of a building, for example, because the sun will come out and it'll heat the building and the ice will fall off. Well, when icicles are hanging off of an ice structure, it's actually one piece of ice. And so there's nothing to cause an icicle to fall. When it gets warm, it'll melt, but it melts at the thinnest point, which is at the bottom, and drips its way up until it's gone. So they form top, you know, they form that way and they go in reverse order when they melt. So on a warm day, you get dripped on. But there's no fear of, you know, if we have low hanging icicles, we'll break them off and make sure that they're not where people will reach them. And then we spend a lot of time every day grooming the trails. That's more of our concern, is where people are walking. We want it to be very safe. So we groom out the ice and the snow so it's kind of soft.
Yeah. So tell us how it works. People have to purchase a ticket mm-hmm. online.
And, that's and the best way. Yeah. People show up and sometimes we'll buy at the gate. It's a little more expensive that way, so it's best to go online. And also on busy nights, you know, sometimes we just have to turn people away if they haven't pre-purchased, just for sake of parking and, you know, not being overcrowded. So, yeah, go to icecastles.com, pick your day, pick your time slot. And the way it works is you have a half hour time window to show up. Once you're in there, you could stay as long as you can tolerate the cold or as long as you want to. There's no, you know, most people end up staying about a half hour, but you could stay longer, you could stay shorter. We like people to show up during, you know, within their window. We've had one of our locations where people show up early because they're afraid there's going to be a long line. And so with everybody showing up earlier, sure enough, there is a long line. If everybody shows up during their time slot, it usually flows pretty well and traffic doesn't get too bad. So we really recommend people go on and find a time that works for them that's available.
Yeah. So what do tickets cost?
Oh, you know, I should have buffed up on that. We have five spots and the tickets are they're different by the day and by the location and whether you buy at the gate or online. So I apologize. We can look it up really quick, but I want to say it's about $7 or $8 for kids and about $12 for adults, depending on the day and if you buy it online.
Okay. So. Here it says children about $9 and then general admission 12 and over,
yeah.
$14.
And that'll vary on the day. That may, for right now, that's probably
Friday.
The price. Yeah, for Friday.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And weekdays when it's not a holiday week like this week has been, then it's going to go down.
Yep. General admission, $10, and then kids are $7. And
yeah.
That's Monday through Thursday. Okay.
You're fast on the computer. You looked that up pretty quick.
In terms of, I mean, how big of a area do people have to walk around in?
We have, this year, we've gone up to 1.5 acres. So we're selling the same amount of tickets as we have in the past per time slot for the sake of parking and for traffic. But once you're in the castle, it feels a lot more comfortable. We have had years in the past where there was no room to even get around in there. It was a little too, we like the energy of the crowd, but it was a little too much energy. This year you get in there and there's a lot of room to explore and it feels a lot better. So 1.5 acres, we have a maze and two kind of longer slides and then three little kid slides and a bunch of other things to explore.
All right. You've got a couple, it looks like, special events. You've got the Enchanted Frozen Sisters that are there at specific times and mm-hmm. then some fire performances.
Yes. And that'll be on the website because it changes. It's not every night that they're there. But they're the fire performers, really exciting in juxtaposition to the ice. And of course, princesses are all the rage right now.
All right. Well, give us a couple of ideas. I mean, there's in terms of people preparing, I mean, they should plan to dress like they're outdoors.
Right.
Or
yeah,
in a refrigerator.
For sure. Yeah, it's surprising. We have actually had people call and inquire, is it cold inside the ice castles? And of course it's cold because it's ice. So, you know, running to your car, running into the store, sometimes you may not get cold. But if you're outside for a half hour or longer, You definitely want to be bundled up. You want to, it's better to have too many layers on. So warm clothes, good shoes or boots. You know, we have the trails groomed, but you don't want your feet getting cold, and you don't want to wear shoes with a really slick tread on them. So that's probably the main thing.
And then if you have kids, you say bring a sled instead of a stroller.
Yeah, you could bring a little sled to pull them around in. The strollers don't roll very well on the ice, on the snow. It's all crunched up. So.
Okay, so you're ready to go? Opening at the Homestead?
Yeah, it's actually open. We've been open, what day is today? We've been open
Friday?
Since Tuesday.
Oh,
so,
okay.
It's going well. We haven't had any, a lot of times opening day can be a little bit, you know, you don't know how parking and everything, but so far everything's going pretty smoothly. So we're open now, and, you know, we sometimes will open through all the way through February, but there's no guarantee. We're totally weather dependent. So.
Okay. That's right.
Yeah.
Whether or not we have the thaw or not. Okay.
Right.
Brent, anything else you think people should know?
No, I think we've covered it all. We're happy that we've had some pretty cooperative weather this year.
Yeah, I bet. Okay, Brent, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Leslie.
It's Brent Christensen with Ice Castles. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. It's 8:51 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, yesterday, the Historic Preservation Board attended the opening of the Ivers Tunnel building in the studio to tell us what this is and why it's important. It's Park City Senior Planner Kirsten Whetstone. Good morning, Kirsten.
Good morning, Leslie.
So this is a building at the Silver Star development?
Yes, it's actually one of the smaller buildings. There's a complex, the Spiro Tunnel Mine Complex. It was part of the Silver King Consolidated Mine Complex. And this is one of the buildings. It was really a shed that protected the entrance to a spur to the Spiro Tunnel. The Spiro Tunnel is one of the drain tunnels that was constructed back to the Thames shaft, which is Thames Canyon, and it goes 17,000 feet back. And this is a spur to it that sits just north of the Silver Star, the little ski shop there that's at the base of the Silver Star lift. The other three buildings, the foundry building, the carpentry building, and the machine shop were all restored when they did the Spiro, or when they called it the Spiro Tunnel Master Plan Development, which we all know today as the Silver Star. So this building was really a shed. It was called the Ivers Tunnel Shed. And I tried to find that this morning, whether that is related to Jim Ivers, and I'm not sure, but I'm sure in the Ivers family. And the original developers of Silver Star had wanted to had gotten permission and a conditional use permit for a little bar, a little après-ski bar called the Shaft Bar. But that was the restoration of this building turned out to be a lot more expensive, and it doesn't seem much. It's just a shed, but it actually did have quite a bit to restore it to where it could be habitable. It was never intended to be habitable, and so now it was restored, and it is for the purpose of a small office building on the site. And the reason it's important, it is just one more building over there that has been now restored to this mine complex. It's one of the council's goals, obviously. Historic preservation is very important in Park City. It reminds us of our past, and it's important for visitors and residents today to know that we care about our past and we treasure these old buildings, and that they can become, you know, usable and part and integrated into the fabric of our life.
Yeah. So how big is it? I mean, the picture I saw, it looked like a big long shed, but it's not that big?
It's not. Well, it's actually bigger than you think. Okay. Before it was restored, it was actually probably almost a foot sunken into the ground. So they brought that up to the surface. And inside, I think it's about 800 square feet. And then they did an addition to the south side. So they actually did an addition onto the side of it where they angled it away from the building, from the front of the building, so it emphasizes, you know, it's not proud of the shack.
So it's a real estate office as opposed to the Opry ski bar then?
Yes, exactly. The real estate office, it took a lot less on the interior to do the restoration, but it really was on a partial foundation. It had a dirt floor. And when I first saw that back when they were doing the Silver Star condominiums, just dark, and it goes back into the mine, and damp, and you just couldn't imagine anybody could ever do anything with it. But they panelized the front and the back, which have a very unique sort of a diagonal boards on it, and then they took all the corrugated metal off the sides, numbered them, and then were able to put them back in once they built the frame, put them back in exactly how they were, and then had to reconstruct the roof. And it's spectacularly tall ceilings in there for what was considered just this equipment shed that protected the tunnel.
And some light as well.
And some light, exactly. That helps. And heat.
Yeah. So this is just close by, I mean, is the main entrance into the Spiro Tunnel, which I guess is just closed to anybody but a water worker?
Yes, and exactly. So north of this shed is what they call the Spiro Tunnel Portal. And that is where there's existing train tracks are still in there, and they can still get back into that mine. And that is the source of some of the water that goes through to the Spiro water treatment plant, which is in the near the golf course. At one time, I think in 1965, they used that Spiro tunnel to access the mine shaft, and then they used that for skiing. I think it only lasted for a couple of years, maybe not even two full seasons, I'm not sure, where people would load into a mine train and go back into the mountain and then come up to the surface with that elevator and then ski back down.
Yeah, near the Thames chairlift is where it all happened.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, that was quite a ride, I guess.
Yes, and interesting that this then is connected to the Thames. And that is another one of the mine sites that is on our list, our historic sites inventory of mining structures. That there's the group of mine sites. I can't remember their name exactly, but Sally Elliott is leading the charge on that, and she was there last night recruiting people to the cause to restore the Thames shaft.
Right. So this building, even though it was in pretty bad shape, was considered, I mean, it was on the city's list of being a significant building?
Yes, it was listed as significant, as all the other buildings there are significant. Mm-hmm. And I was surprised. I thought that because most of those buildings were restored, they're very impressive industrial buildings that were built in the 1900s, more in the mature mining age, and that they're not eligible for the National Register, which I think it might be interesting to look into that a little bit more, because they were restored in place, and they didn't panelize anything, and they're very distinctive mining buildings in Park City, remind us of our past.
Okay, well, take a look next time I'm there.
Okay, that would be great.
All right, Kirsten, thanks.
Thanks, Leslie.
KPCW News Time now, 8:58.